Right. Good morning to everybody, and thank you for attending this panel session on security and transport strategies in smart cities. I think when we think of major sporting events, the images that prop up in our minds are generally, you know, the excitement on the field of play, what to expect, the excitement of being part of a once-in-a-lifetime event in that particular host city or country, and generally just having fun. However, behind the scenes, there's obviously a lot of duck paddling happening under the surface. And I think what we need to understand is that major sporting events are actually short-term initiatives that have major long-term impact. And we must also understand that these sporting events pose a tremendous challenge to host nations in terms of their image, their sovereignty, and their national integrity. And of course, what we've also come to realize, and this we pick up in the media every day, for every major sporting event that's being planned or hosted in every country, is that there are major complexities, there are numerous interdependencies, a number of stakeholders, and all of this with the materials, the resources, the planning, the timelines, the issues, the problems that these host nations face, it all has to be managed professionally, successfully, under the watchful eye of the international media, and of course the public. The public becoming ever more involved, as we've seen in Brazil last year, and in other parts of the world. And of course, one of the challenges is not the least, is the extent and the effectiveness of people's security strategies, their plans, and of course, the costs thereof. And over the past few years, I think you'll agree with me that the increase in cost to host major sporting events in general has increased astoundingly. And of course, together with this, the cost of security strategies and operational plans has increased as well. And I think just to help you understand to what extent this has actually occurred, the ICSS obviously does a lot of research in terms of, or in order to help us remain informed, in touch, and to actually see where we can make a difference. And if you look at the cost of, for instance, the Summer Olympics, on average, pre-9/11, we're talking for security operations approximately $118 million. Post 9/11, on average for a Summer Olympics security planning operations, we're looking at $3.4 billion. 118 million to 3.4 billion. That's 28 times more. That's just the security costs. Now, obviously, there's reasons for this. The threat landscape is ever-changing, ever-evolving. Things that have come up over the past year or so, which were never an issue, drones, cybersecurity. I did an assessment on the Brazil 2014 FIFA World Cup last year, and when we had the debrief with the FIFA security head and his team the day after the match, we learned that they had over 10,000 credible cyber attacks on the facility. We're not talking the ticketing website or the FIFA website. We're talking the actual stadium and environment. From the lighting, the power, the surveillance, the big screen, the PA system, which obviously played the national anthems, and there was an issue with that at Fortaleza a few matches later, where one of the anthems wasn't played. And if you look at the more recent Summer Olympics for 2012 as well, during the entire event, they experienced over 2.3 billion credible, in other words, recorded and actual, verified cyber attacks. Now that's huge. So drones, cyber attacks, 3D printed plastic firearms, these are all new issues that we have to deal with. and we have to come up with mitigation strategies that are effective, affordable, and that are safe. We can't shoot a drone out of the air and have it land on people or a team bus or whatever the case may be. But of course, one of the other reasons, apart from the ever-evolving threat landscape, is the fact that people have planned poorly. And part of that means some aspects have been planned late. And the later they're planned, the more they cost, because your back is up against the wall. So what we've seen in our research is that on average for any event, not just Summer Olympics, security budgets have been exceeded by 77%. If we look at some of the events, some have even exceeded their security budgets by 105%. Now that's huge. Somebody has to give a very good reason for why that actually occurred. So obviously we see that the responsibility on bidding nations and eventual organizing committees who actually have to stage these events, the responsibility is becoming ever greater for them to determine, manage, and defend their security plans and budgets. This, of course, includes government and organizing committee budgets, which cover various aspects, from border control all the way through to the transport hubs, the transport modes, the technology that's being used for that, if it's vehicle registration plate readers, under-vehicle scanners, surveillance systems, etc. And obviously integrating all of these systems, international command centers, etc., this is a very costly item. Of course, there's also the security design of these facilities, whether it's transport hubs, routes, whether it's the actual sport facilities, training sites, the broadcast center, airports, railway stations. The security design of these facilities is key to be done early in order to design risk out from the beginning. Saves a lot of effort afterwards when the operators come in and they have to make changes to these facilities. Costs a lot of money, a lot of headaches, and actually, when you follow what we call at the ICSS the Apache model, somebody designs and builds something, the operator comes in and he says, wow, they want me to operate it like this, but it's built like that. How do we get this match a little bit closer to each other? And getting that match closer from design to operations costs money and time, and you try and patch up here and there, the Apache model. But all you're actually doing is dispersing one risk area to somewhere else in that precinct. And sometimes that results in certain incidents or crime being able to be committed. The scary part of all this, I think, from all of the assessments that we've done for organizing committees, for sport federations, and just for our research and development, is the fact that the people who have to plan the security operations usually reinvent the security planning wheel as if it never existed. There was never another event like this or any other sporting event. And that's the scary thing, because there doesn't seem to be a global framework, a global model, which people can take. Even if you get the previous host nation's documentation, and maybe it's the best plan in the world or the best one for that event ever, the question is, how do you know that they've covered all the aspects, they've covered it properly, and that the time allocation, the project scheduling, was actually timely and not too late? There's no benchmark for that. You can't compare against some model. And that in itself is a major risk. So the question, I think, is how security can fulfill its mandate by minimizing risk, which is the key objective, whilst optimizing cost and preventing creating a security event instead of a sporting event. Now, some of the basics to do this is obviously involve security up front as early as possible. Let them do the threat and the risk assessments on which all of your mitigation and solutions should be based. I mean, you can't just decide we need this security and that technology. There has to be a need for it. This has to be done up early before you even choose your sites and your facilities for fan zones, the sport venues, etc. One has to apply a holistic and integrated approach. This also means that whatever security requirements there are have to be integrated into the other components of your organizing committee. From the design of the facilities, instead of just a sexy, iconic sport facility that will blow your mind, it has to be functional, and it has to be safe and secure. That has to be designed in. A brief should be given to the architect before he starts to pen the look and feel of the building. So security and operations should be built in first, then the architect starts drawing the sexy, iconic venue. Never happens. Never happens. And a lot of you sitting here have been involved in sporting events or own a facility or a club. You will know. The operator is the guy, you know, sort of towards the end when you're sitting there with the key in the front door, and you think, who do we give the key to? Who's actually running this facility? And it's another 6 months maybe for a tender, and you know, eventually you get somebody. And then they come and they've got this that faces them. And then the fun starts. Common sense. But trust me, if there's 1% of facilities that are planned and designed properly and operated properly, it's a lot. It really is a lot. And I think ensuring post-event legacy to manage the investment of all of this cost that you put into your security planning is key as well. And trust me, that's another a weak point for many organizing committees. Apart from the facilities and so on, what about the security investment that you've made? And legacy, the key thing that we must remember is, although it's implemented last, at the end of the event, closing accounts, handing over the assets, getting your receipt, that's the easy part. The important part is up front, in the beginning, when you do your strategizing and your due diligence. The question is, how do we deal with legacy? How do we budget to implement legacy in the beginning so it will work in the end? There's a lot we can say about that. And then, of course, budgeting properly for all of this. And when I say budgeting properly, there's one thing I've never seen either. For any bid, especially, and the issue is always the cost of the event, but also for security. And what I've never seen is that people have based their costing on net present value costing basis, NPV. In other words, if you say today when you are awarded or you're bidding maybe for an event which is in 8, maybe 10 years' time, you are saying, let's say security will be $1 billion. But when you actually get it and when you actually start hosting the event, maybe 6 years, 7 years later, that $1 billion has now become $3 billion. And the public is in uproar, public accounts committees are asking questions. The point is, it's actually the same value. But because of inflation and so on, net present value, you know, it's 30 million now, but in net present value terms, it's actually $1 billion. So I think in achieving the above, all of these best practices, you can either minimize, if not omit, all your duplications, your rework, your delays, your penalties, incorrect use of materials and resources. And of course, as I've said before, this sounds like common sense. The question is, when will we actually make it common practice? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Malcolm. I'll just pass you over now to Owen Evans from Sport Business, who will introduce the next panel.
Hello, everyone. Is this working? Hi, I'm Owen Evans. It's editor of Sport Business International. Thank you, Malcolm, for that presentation. As we've said, this is technology and security for our second session of the day, not two of the most glamorous factors in sport event hosting or even host city organisation. However, as we've just heard, becoming two of the biggest strains on the budget, and as a result, two of the most important aspects where we have to think about at the strategy stage. To introduce the rest of our panel today, we've got Panos, and this is where I fall down on the first hurdle. Panos okay. Panos Protopaustis, is that right? Almost there. Almost there. And we've got Tone Grinland from Stavanger, from the head of economic development now. Panos, can we just begin with you? We've got a transport expert, we've got an economic expert, and we've got a security expert here, and all our panelists today have said that rather than just talk about their own perspectives, they're quite happy to treat this as an open surgery. So if there's anything we all know now with the great transparency drive under the IOC that our consultants are well rewarded for their advice, so this is your opportunity to get a little bit of pro bono work. If you're a host city or event promoter and you're looking for something specific, they're more than happy to take your queries on stage or after when we go to the coffee break. Panos, if we could begin with you on the transport side. I was reading your piece about the 2024 bids for the US, the help you were doing advising last year, when Boston were the preferred bid. Now we switched to LA. Tell me about LA and its transport system. What do you think about it?
Well, that's a big. It's a short question, but it has to be a long answer. I'll try to summarize it.
That way?
Yeah, try to summarize it. LA actually is, I would say, completely the opposite from Boston. Boston is a small city. It would have many challenges in hosting the most mega of the mega events. However, there were a lot of innovation and a lot of innovative concepts that were being elaborated. LA, on the other hand, is now in the process of a big, huge, I would say, transportation transformation program. A major investment program has been already approved, and they are in the process of implementation of that. That will mean that in 5, in 10 years' time, the average split in terms of mode of transport, where you have now 90% to 95% private cars, you will shift gradually towards a more European mix with 30% to 40% public transport. That means that they will invest big time in public transport systems. And I think that will be a major transformation of LA, and that is one of the, I would say, key things that addresses transport in mega events, in that when you think about your games plan, games transport plan, before actually addressing that, you should think of what is my city strategic plan. And LA is actually doing that transformation for the benefit of the city and the community, and on that it will overlay the games plan. I think it will be quite an interesting outcome. It will be a very innovative U.S. concept, quite different than all the previous U.S. Games, winter or summer games. And I think it will be a big first for the U.S.
Now, you've had more than 25 years in this particular field, most recently with Baku in the summer at the inaugural European Games. From your perspective, that's at completely the other end of the scale, isn't it? A brand new city in relative terms, creating a new transport network. What's the easiest challenge for you, looking at trying to sort out LA's transportation system or going into a blank canvas like a Baku and creating a long-term legacy on the back of that?
You're quite right. It's like looking at the two ends of a pendulum. It's Baku had to organize the European Games. European Games, the first, so there was no benchmark. There were other continental games to look at, but it was not European Games per se. And at the same time, you had less than 2 years to plan, set it up, and run it. So it was a kind of challenge of that sort. So again in Baku, we had to actually, I would say, follow a similar planning cycle, but much more accelerated, using a lot of international examples, but also rationalizing wherever we had the opportunity, and introducing innovations across the field, not only transport. Transport is does have the impact, because normally when you talk about transport and transport infrastructure, it's very big money, it's very heavy infrastructure, and you know, once you are you start going in one direction, there is no way back. So if I could summarize two or three points that Baku has benefited from that, one is that it has now a good know-how of planning, integrated planning the organizers, integrating the organizers of the games, but also the city aspect in all different levels, government, municipal. Some new ways of transport services were introduced, and they were also, we got the IOC quite interested in those, so we may be seeing them implemented gradually in Olympic Games, like moving away from the concept of dedicated cars for VIPs, limos, and moving more towards on-demand services. Still very high level, but on-demand services, so you rationalize the resources. And integration between traffic and public transport. And Baku, by the way, is a city that has had very, very bad traffic record because of the rapid growth and the motorization growth rate. I think that now is more manageable. Still not the end of the story, but I think it's a pretty good legacy that the games have left behind.
Okay, and before we move on to Tony, if there's anyone here that either went to Baku and had their own reflections that they'd like to pass on to panels or has a transport-related query, if there's any questions now, feel free to put your hand up. If not, we can move on to find out about smart cities. And Tony, just see you at the end there. We heard about smart cities in the first session today. Stavanger is a slightly different, it's a lighthouse project in EU terms. Can you give us a little bit of background about what it means to you?
Absolutely. A smart city, you all heard about the smart cities. We all have different concepts of what a smart city really is. In our case, it's a way of being a city. I think I will keep a quite strict city perspective here in this panel because we are a few cities on the panel. For us, we are meeting the events. You are meeting us. The city's roles are changing. It's changing because of urbanization. That's one aspect. The other one is that cities are changing in the way we provide services to the inhabitants. Stavanger is a hub for oil and gas in all of Europe. We have a lot of the main offices, the global main offices in Europe, and we have been since the 60s. That means that we have a lot of technology skills in our region. Technology from the oil and gas sector can easily be transferred from offshore to onshore. I'll give you two examples. One, on the platforms in the North Sea, they need to have medical services. Okay, we have good video solutions. Sounds easy, but it's not easy, I'll tell you. We operate video solutions for Nigeria, for the platforms, for here in the North Sea platforms. And the doctors can actually go in and help the nurse who is on the platform to give medical treatment in all kinds of emergencies. That technology can be used in the city as a service from the city to elderly people staying longer at homes, to other people who need services, and it's the video quality, the technology is so good that it's as a citizen, it's you don't think of it as like a bad movie from the 80s or something. You feel that the person is almost present. That's one example. Another one, I don't know, you probably live in a city or somewhere where the roads sometimes are opened to fix something. You know, you cannot go the normal way because somebody is fixing something. Well, offshore, deep, you cannot open something to fix it because it will be a disaster if you open something on deep sea. That means that the drilling technology from offshore can be used in cities to just don't open the street, to check it with the technology. And this is just two examples of how in the region of Stavanger we have this and use this technology transfer from the oil and gas industry to being a smart city. It's no secret that the oil price dropped, and that has an effect. That has an innovative effect on our region. Smart innovative is something which you can, well, you can use it however you like. But the point is, who of you like to have a new computer system? Honestly, who likes it? Shouldn't be more than maximum 5% of you. Nobody. No, exactly. The point is, we all would like to change. We all would like to be smart and innovative, but we don't like to change. That's like the instinct that we have. We don't want to change. We want to change, but we don't want to change ourselves. And becoming a smart city, it's about realizing that the city is actually, it has to turn the way that we work. The events have to change the way they work. The meeting between the events and the cities involving the citizens, it has to change. And that's quite uncomfortable because it worked for a long time, the things we did. So we can just continue for a little bit longer with whatever we did. No, we have to change the things and how we do things. So that's a little bit like the smart city perspective. As a host city, we need to work on different kinds of events. Sometimes we own the events, like the tall ships race is something that the city of Stavanger is in charge of. Sometimes we just have like the premises, like 10,000 scouts came, boys and girls, to camp. Then we need to find somewhere where it's safe, for sure. But it's a good premise, and we just have the land for it. Sometimes we, like when we were the cultural capital of Europe in 2008, we made an organization, and we are partly the owner of the organization, but we don't run the event as such. And then for different sports events, we have the venues that we need to have, the infrastructure. The city as such, for traffic and the mobility, well, really in the smart city, you talk about mobility rather than traffic as such, because it's also about the infrastructure which makes it possible to not actually move from one place to another. We can have a meeting and I can be on the screen and we talk because it's a good optical solution and we are meeting and talking. So for the mobility, it's the municipality has a lot, but for the traffic in Stavanger, the case is that it's only parking that we're in charge of because the police and the National Authority for the Roads are in charge of the other things. But what we did in our case to make it easier for events to come is to say that, okay, we'll have a contact point. So whenever somebody wants to have an event in the Stavanger region, they only have to contact one person instead of police, firemen, any kind of security that we are working on with the department, the Norwegian Department of Security. There is one contact point. And that's also a way of, you know, thinking, can we do something differently because it's complicated for an external event coming in and having to speak and get to know all different local people. So I think Smart City is, it's mainly about integrating services. It's about seeing the connection between ICT solutions with people, with mobility, energy solutions, and just finding, you know, where is it possible to connect things. And sometimes it can make you dizzy because everything is connected. Everything can be connected. But it has to be.
Thank you. And panelists, I may have misinterpreted it, but I saw you taking notes while Tony was talking then. This notion of a smart city, is it all well and good for a city of a certain size and a certain direction with the kind of cohesiveness at a governmental level that everyone does go in the right direction? But when you're looking at a Istanbul or an LA that has fundamental transport problems, they're too swollen, they're too established to change to this kind of blueprint.
Yeah, it's a very good point. It's a very good question. A lot of the smart city concepts nowadays more and more are incorporated into games, transport or mobility planning, and it should be that way. Now, for the big cities, as you quite right said, that they have a bit more fundamental, I would say, problems or issues to resolve. There are things to be done before that or in parallel. You mentioned Istanbul. Istanbul had a fantastic bid plan for the 2020 Games. I think that the big challenges there were the amount of new infrastructure that had to be implemented in a very short period of time. Nevertheless, given time and through infrastructure primarily, because it has to be done that way, these issues will be faced. So for the big cities, when you talk about LA or Istanbul or cities that do face these challenges, infrastructure needs to come first. In other cities, like Paris, for example, for the 2024 now, they are in a much better position. However, still, they will improve certain things, and the smart city concepts will be much more, I would say, pronounced there.
So just picking up on that point, if you're looking at the 2024 race from a purely transporting perspective, would Paris be the forefront? Would they be the favourites?
Maybe I could ask the question from the audience. Who would favor Paris for the 2024? There you go. LA?
I've spoken.
What do you think?
And you?
I think it will be, I think the Olympic movement, and I really mean it, it will benefit from both these candidacies. I think the two concepts will be quite different, very innovative and very creative, different approaches, but for equally very strong contenders.
Understood. Malcolm, bring it back to security and with you. In your presentation, you mentioned there was one occasion where overspend on security reached 105%. Which was that, can you say?
I'll need some protection when I leave the floor. It was the 2012 London Olympics.
Okay, so does that necessarily mark it down as a failure, the fact that you had that overspend? I mean, that overspend against the final product of the security. How do you measure against the two?
Look, it's not necessarily a failure. I think the London Olympics did a lot of things excellently. And like for any organizing committee, you know, you've got your challenges. The question is, how do you deal with them when they arise? We all know about the G4S debacle and, you know, the lack of security guards now. How you realize that a week before you open, I don't know. That's a tricky one for me to understand. I have my thoughts, but still, that's the fact of the matter. The fact that they addressed the issue, I mean, I was there, I did an assessment. The military were fantastic. I mean, how you get people in a few days before to actually understand their venue, the facilities, the protocols, policies, procedures, it's phenomenal. So they had an issue, they addressed it, it worked well, they were commended. I think where they actually set the benchmark, though, for all major sporting events, and this I can say unequivocally, was in the realm of security design of their facilities. And it wasn't just the sport facilities. It was the integrated city precinct, the footprint, the event footprint, which included traffic, the hubs, the technology linked to the National Command Center, where all of the service providers, fire, police, emergency medical services, all had access to the monitors, the vehicles that they were searching for, maybe because they were on some threat database from the intelligence services. All of this was integrated. It was done phenomenally well. They actually did the security design from the beginning as per the common sense model. So they did make it common practice, but I'm not aware of anyone before them that has done it, and especially to that degree. And for that, they are commended. For me, that is a case study in security design, because that's usually the one area where it is too late or nothing happens.
I see. And only because you bring up London 2012, one of the other phrases you were saying in your presentation was, it feels like we're reinventing the wheel from a security perspective at every Games. Despite all the great PR, and it is having a great year, the IOC, probably more so due to FIFA's achievements in comparison, is this still a failing? Because so much of the IOC's good work is the transfer of knowledge from game to game. Rio will be working their respective predecessors from London, and the cycle goes on. Why is that not being seen in the security side? Why is there not that global framework that you mentioned?
Well, before I answer, FIFA, for instance, as the biggest sporting event on the globe, started an initiative during the 2006 FIFA World Cup where they would actually start to gather this kind of intelligence, put it in a database, and start sharing it with future World Cups. But for some reason, that ran dead. I'm not sure why. So the biggest sporting event in the world does not have even their own blueprint. Now, the IOC do have a thick Bible of requirements and so on. They've got checklists and whatnot, but that's a checklist. You know, I don't know how often it's revised and all the rest of it, but in terms of knowing whether that checklist that you receive from your sport federation is actually adequate, it addresses all the issues, it's kept pace with the way that the threat landscape has been evolving, that is another issue. Now, I don't want to say too much, but we've obviously picked this up because when the organizing committee is actually awarded this event, we always hear two questions, and we've been involved in events ourselves, obviously. I'm an ex-cop, so I've done it from a policing governmental point of view. I understand what the cops want, what the government wants, and the requirements that must be met by the organizer and the host organizing committee. But I've also done it from the organizing committee's point of view. So I've got a pretty good overview of what the challenges, issues, and expectations are. And the bottom line is, there's always two questions that are asked. Number one, now we've got it, where do we start? And it kills me to hear that, because why do you not know? And then the second thing is, where do we get information? So, of course, they run to the previous host. And as I said earlier, how do you know? It doesn't matter how great that documentation is. How do you know that something isn't missing, something wasn't bad or poorly planned or late? And if you look at the London Olympics, one of the other areas that they were weak in terms of transport, was their plan to secure the transport of goods for the event. So in other words, the material screening facilities to check the cargo. I mean, let's face it, we spend £100 million securing the Olympic Park, and then we drive a little SUV in with flowers for the VVIP unit box on the morning of the game or the match or whatever we're dealing with, and maybe it wasn't screened or screened properly. So you've got this Trojan horse running straight through £100 million worth of security, and it's all worthless, because you have one system and it must work effectively, incorporating all the other bits and bobs. So the material screening facilities, and I assess them myself, some of the massive RapiScan 500 cargo scanners were still in plastic. They weren't switched on. I watched vehicles go through. There was like 100 boxes in some of the vehicles. They would look inside. I mean, the fact that there could have been a secret panel or, you know, who knows? Bit of a belly scope underneath, and good to go, here's your tag, and Bob's your uncle. The security that was there didn't speak English. Some of them were Gurkhas. Which, if you follow the history, they couldn't pass their training because the training was in English. Some of them went to the same training course 5 times and they couldn't pass. But they were appointed nonetheless because they needed bodies on the ground. So these are some of the key areas, and the key fact here is that the material screening facilities were planned rather late in the day. Now, what we must understand is, when it comes to material screening facilities, you've actually got to identify a plot of ground that makes sense on your routes for vehicles to veer off, get searched, and then carry on to wherever they're supposed to be off to. You've got to rent that ground. You've got to set it up with your infrastructure. And you've got to manage it and break it down all again. And you've got to be able to do all that. And it should actually be done so far early in the event that it's actually in the host city contract. So that when the country is awarded, this is all in the host city's contract. But if it isn't, I guarantee you 100%, they will arm wrestle you on the day that you come to the host city and say, right, this is what we need. And I'll say, what? Okay, that's going to cost you £100 million as well for the period of 2.5 months. And then you're going to start arm wrestling, and then the budget starts climbing, and it goes crazy, and it gets warped.
Fascinating. We are getting the signal. That's two fingers now, so that would be 2 minutes. And if there are any questions that you'd like to put to the panel? Yep, a couple of chaps up there.
Eric Anderson, Arabs. A question to Malcolm, a practical question. The UK Green Guide for Safety and Security at Sports Venues is now probably, 7 or 8 years old. Do you know of any initiative to actually update that? And what new measures need to be put into that guide when it eventually comes out?
Well, I am aware that SGSA, Sports Grounds Safety Association, is busy with an update. I'm not too sure exactly what they're doing in terms of the updates, but as we know, it's all safety. There's a little bit of security in there to a certain extent, but it's 98% is safety. I think you'd have to ask SGSA, to be quite honest, what exactly they're updating. But I would say that if you look at some of the incidents that have occurred from a safety point of view, technology has changed in building materials. There's different factors that have now come to the fore. Crash barriers or crush barriers, for instance. There's a lot more advanced materials that are available. So I think this may affect some of the dimensions that you need for the width of walkways, et cetera, et cetera. Seating has changed phenomenally. So maybe they're revising. And I think to a large extent, some of the facility owners would like to see more people in them. Of course, the issue of safe standing has now come back to the UK. And if it's done properly, I think there's merit in looking at that. So maybe that's another area that they would possibly feel they should address as well, to actually make sure that safe standing is safe.
Excellent. Final question.
Thank you, firstly, the panel. I've been really interested in this. We happen to be involved in the SGSA update as well, so there's things happening on crowd dynamics, for example. Firstly, a word in defense of architects, the designers of those venues that you referred to at the beginning, and my overlay colleagues who understand similarly on a technical level. I think we're actually in agreement, because often when we receive a brief, the page on security is blank or simply a legend rather than a map, if that's a fair comment. We see frequently events, more on the FIFA than on the IOC side, that cherry-pick platitudes. But what we need is that map, because we understand equally the story, but we don't know how it applies to the venue. So that was that. I'm interested in what you're saying about the London 2012 and couple of anecdotes you gave. We'll talk at length about that. I specifically wanted to ask you, Malcolm, about the breakdown, perhaps the breakdown in what you describe as the Apache approach on the basketball venue. And, or are you familiar with this?
No, actually, I didn't do them. We were a team, so we were assigned different components of the event. I was at the handball. I don't know if that would help. But
the issue on, I don't mean to offend others that may be closer to the subject. So the issue with the basketball venue was designed from the outset as a temporary thing, and it came very close to transferring to Rio, being sold. And I feel it was a breakdown between the interests of all stakeholders that the security team chose to demand the welding of all bolted connections, which meant it had to be cut up to pieces and it couldn't be resold. Ultimately, what Rio would have bought was the field of play, because the seats were rented, the shell was gone now, and there was a missed opportunity, which may have helped offset savings, for example.
Look, all I can say is I do know that the security team of the of LOCOG and, of course, the Home Office did do an analysis, as I said, from very early on. And obviously things change. You know, when it comes to overlay, what you spec, what you finally order, what actually gets delivered, and how it gets installed, you know, it's all a different tale. And at the end of it, they constantly had to do their assessments. And I know that I think the velodrome had to be hardened on the one end, and I think maybe it was something similar to the basketball arena where they felt that maybe it was close to a public road or a waterway or something, and maybe it was at risk. And if someone was actually to get close enough to plant a bomb or to fire a mortar, it would actually disintegrate to such an extent that it would cause more damage than the explosion itself or, you know, the collapse. So they do these kind of analyses, and I think in the end they decided in terms of managing that risk, would rather lose the income or the revenue and that legacy and make sure things are safe and secure for that particular venue.
Excellent. I'm going to have to wrap it up there. We're getting lots of stern looks and watch checking. Shane, we've only just scratched the surface, so thank you very much for listening today, and thanks very much to our panellists. They will be around all day today if you want to speak to them.